Hogwarts, 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 teach us something.
Hello, and welcome to Wizard Studies.
Join us as we peruse all things Potter.
Hello, and welcome to Wizard Studies. I'm Katie.
And I'm Audrey.
Today we're going to be talking about everybody's favorite baddie, Draco Malfoy.
Not a good start to that.
Hey.
Okay. So Draco's name. Draco is the Latin word for dragon, and it also comes from the name of the constellation in the northern sky. And so this is a theme with black family names being from constellations. So that might have been Narcissa's choice. I don't know. We'll see. Malfoy is from French, and Malfoy in French means bad faith or unfaithful. So pretty much right there we learn a little bit about the Malfoy clan. And his last name could have been the Smart, Sphinx, or Spongin, which were all things that J.K. had in her earlier drafts. But I'm glad she went with Malfoy, because those all kind of sound... They sound kind of, like, dweeby. Not bad boy.
Yeah, and it's interesting that all of them start with S. I wonder if she was going for, like, a Slytherin thing with the double S's, and then doing an S last name. And then she ended up with Malfoy. His birthday is June 5th, 1980. We're going to talk a little bit later about his star sign and how that possibly plays into his relationship with some of the other characters.
And then his wand is Hawthorn and Unicorn Air, and it's 10 inches precisely. So this is a pretty important wand in the series because it's the wand that Harry takes from him at Malfoy Manor, and then defeats Voldemort with, because the wand has changed allegiances to Harry. And then, so just to go over what Ollivander has said about Hawthorn and Unicorn Hair, Hawthorn is known to make a strange, contradictory wand, as full of paradoxes as the tree that gave it birth, whose leaves and blossoms heal, and yet whose cut branches smell of death. So I think that's pretty cool, because we know Draco kind of has this dual nature. So we can see that in his wand wood. Hawthorn wands are complex and intriguing, just like their owners. They're adept at curses, which I think is something that Draco's pretty good at too, and are most at home with a conflicted nature, which is definitely Draco. There's also, like, references to periods of turmoil and stuff, so Hawthorne's definitely a pretty good fit for Draco. Ollivander said that he would only ever consider placing a Hawthorn wand in the hands of a witch or wizard of proven talent, which is interesting because Draco was 11 when he got this wand, so I wonder if there was something about his magic as a kid that made him particularly extraordinary or something, because we know that kids do show magic, so maybe he started showing it really early, or I don't know, his baby magic was good. He also has unicorn hair, which are generally the most difficult ones to turn to the dark arts, and that's pretty not true with Draco. We do see him going to the dark arts. And the other interesting thing is that they remain strongly attached to their first owner, which, again, doesn't fit with this wand because we know that it changes allegiances to Harry. So, verdict is that Hawthorn fits pretty well with Draco in this wand, but I think unicorn hair, not so much. Which I feel like the cores, I mean, we get less specificity because Ollivander only uses 3. So, I don't know, I'm always a little bit disappointed with... Or usually, I'm a little disappointed with the wand cores and how they match up.
Yep, and I think that it's very... Did you talk about how... sorry, I was posting on our Instagram, sorry. Did you talk about how it's... Hawthorns are particularly hard to, or sorry, unicorn hair wands are like attached to their first owner, and how we see Harry like literally just grab it out of Malfoy's hand.
Oh yeah, yeah, the other yeah. I didn't mention that. Harry doesn't even win it with the trusty Expelliarmus.
No, he just literally like this scene in the movie is so funny. They're like and like grabs it. It's like such a little like 2-year-old like fighting over the last cookie or something. But yeah, and like Ollivander confirms that it switches allegiances to Harry by just grabbing it, which I think is interesting. And I think that the path of the Elder Wand is very interesting in this series, and whether I believe the path that J.K. set out for us is something different. There is a very interesting video on YouTube that I've watched about kind of trying to make sense of the whole Elder Wand and how the Hawthorne Wand plays into the history of how who has allegiance of the Elder Wand and when, and whether the one that's laid out for us in the books by Harry is actually the accurate timeline, which is very interesting.
Yeah.
But I recommend it. So Draco's house is Slytherin. He gets sorted into that his first day at Hogwarts when the sorting ceremony happens, and he is sorted into Slytherin instantly. I think there is like a mention that the hat barely touches his head before he is sorted into Slytherin.
And then his parents are Lucius and Narcissa Malfoy, who we know made a name of Black because she is Sirius's cousin and Bellatrix's sister. And Katie's going to get a little bit more, or a lot more, into his parents there. And then that's the end of his Pottermore fact file. There's nothing about skills and hobbies, which I think is kind of weird because Draco is such a big character. JK, as far as skills, JK has said that he was skilled at Occlumency, which he apparently learned from Bellatrix. I think she said all of this in an interview. And then she said that he was good, ended up being good at Occlumency because he's very capable of compartmentalizing his life and his emotions. I think that's probably something he had to do growing up in the Malfoy family. She also said that, and I think this is in the same interview, she said that at the end of Half-Blood Prince, or at least up until that point, he was incapable of producing a Patronus because Hogwarts hadn't taught it at all. It's not something that you typically learn, unlike Lupin teaching Harry, or Harry teaching the rest of Dumbledore's army. And this makes sense because I don't see why anyone would go out of their way to teach Draco on the side. Like, he doesn't have someone in his life that's going to be like, you need to protect yourself against Dementors. Like, think of a happy memory. And I wonder if he would even be capable of it if he was taught it, because I don't know. From what we know about Draco, doesn't seem like he would have any memories that are, like, that happy. Because we know it has to be really, really strong. And I know that there are some characters that are unable to produce, so I wonder if Draco could. It's a good question for Joe.
Yeah, and I wonder what like, Hermione and Ron's happy memories are. Because I think one of the reasons why Harry's can be so powerful is that his memory, like, I think it ends up being, like, him remembering his parents, remembering, quote-unquote, kind of piecing together what happened with the Dementors and how, like, riding on his broom isn't even good enough.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if even I would really have. Like, I have a very happy life, a happy childhood, but I just think that, like, the memory needed to produce a Patronus, at least from you see, like, Harry's memory, has to be so powerfully happy. Like, I don't even know if I would have one that would be good enough to create a corporeal Patronus, especially. Yeah. So I think it would be interesting to see kind of what everybody else's memories are, just to see if they're, like, if there's a middle ground where Harry, like, Harry's is so happy and so his Patronus is so powerful, but kind of just, like, a mediocre Patronus might be what I could produce. So, we always talk about a character's first mention in a series. So, Draco's first mention was in the book Sorcerer's Stone, and we meet him in Madame Malkin's when he's getting fitted for his robes in Diagon Alley when Harry is there with Hagrid. So the quote from that point in the book is, "In the back of a shop, a boy with a pale pointed face was standing on a footstool while a second witch pinned up his long black robes." And in this meeting, we hear Draco talk about kind of his disdain for Muggleborns, his disdain for Hagrid, and this really hits Harry because even though he's not a Muggleborn, everything that Draco's saying about Muggleborns, about, oh, like, they wouldn't know how to do this, they wouldn't know anything coming into Hogwarts, that's Harry's position. He feels like Draco could be talking to him even though he's not a Muggleborn in this situation. And then he's kind of being rude to Hagrid, and Hagrid is the only person that Harry knows in the wizarding world. He's his only friend right now. And so Harry and Draco don't get off on the best foot. And then Draco later, when he finds out who Harry is, because he doesn't know that Harry is Harry Potter when they meet in the shop, he finds this out on the Hogwarts Express, and then he offers his hand in friendship to Harry, kind of trying to get him to join forces, but Harry is kind of like, nah, bitch, you rude, I'm better friends. And Draco's like, you would pick Ron over me, a Weasley? And just him basically being a pretentious prick from the moment we meet him.
Yep, pretty spot on there.
To be honest, it stays about the same throughout the entire series.
Yeah.
And being a pretentious prick.
Yeah, pretty much. I think everybody likes to, like, think back on Draco, like, really positively. And there are some things that we should give him credit for, but he is a pretentious prick.
Yeah.
All right, so moving on to his Myers-Briggs type. Draco was assigned INTJ, which is dubbed the Architect, and these traits are introverted, intuitive, thinking, and judging. So, just jumping right in, the first passage I found said, "It's only at the top, and being one of the rarest and most strategically capable personality types, INTJs know this all too well. It is often a challenge for them to find like-minded individuals who are able to keep up with their relentless intellectualism and chess-like maneuvering. People with the INTJ personality type are imaginative yet decisive, ambitious yet private, amazingly curious, but they do not squander their energy." So I think the struggle to find like-minded individuals is really relevant for Draco. He doesn't really have any true friends that are similar to him, even within his house. His two best friends, or I don't even know if they're called friends, are Crabbe and Goyle. And they're just henchmen, basically. And then he has kind of a relationship with Pansy Parkinson, but it seems more that he just likes the attention, and I don't think he actually, like, enjoys being around her. I mean, I honestly think she's annoying, so.
Yeah.
I wonder how different Draco could be if he had found someone that had, like, a similar mind to him, maybe, but had been raised in a better house where it was, he was taught to, like, love and stuff, and then if Draco had become friends with this person, maybe he could have grown up a lot faster, I think. And I think this whole idea is really relevant in Half-Blood Prince when Draco has no one to confide in. Harry almost always immediately goes to Hermione and Ron to help him out, and then he has Sirius, and he has so much love and people around him, and Draco does not have that. I mean, he's been tasked with one of the scariest, hardest things, been told that his family's going to die if he doesn't kill Dumbledore. And he succeeds. I mean, he doesn't kill Dumbledore, but he does succeed in getting the Death Eaters in. But this whole time, he's so, like, moody and tormented because he doesn't have anyone to help him.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next thing, which I did not really agree with, was with a natural thirst for knowledge that shows itself early in life, INTJs are often given the title of bookworm as children. Definitely wouldn't call Draco a bookworm. He gives off the appearance of not really caring about school because he's bullying all the time. But I think it is noteworthy that he's a good student. I mean, he did well enough in potions to make it into in the sixth year. So I don't know if he did well enough before Snape before Slughorn came along and lowered the thing, but I mean he seems to do well in school when he's not bullying other people, but he's definitely not a bookworm.
No, I don't think I would consider him one of those either.
And then INTJs tend to believe that with effort, intelligence, and consideration, nothing is impossible, while at the same time they believe that people are too lazy, short-sighted, or self-serving to actually achieve those fantastic results. And I, again, this comes to Half-Blood Prince, which I think a lot of the stuff with Draco comes up, but he doesn't really believe that other people can accomplish great things, but, I mean, he puts all this work into fixing the Vanishing Cabinet, and he succeeds. Sorry, my dog is barking. I don't know if you can hear this. So, yeah, he is able to do the seemingly impossible. But I don't think he would believe that anyone else could do the sort of thing that he does. Like, he just sees them as lazy and not very smart. And many fictional villains and misunderstood heroes have this personality type, which I think is interesting. I mean, I think Draco is more of, like, a misunderstood villain, so, like, a hybrid of the two. He's definitely not the biggest villain in this series, but, like, at times to Harry and the trio, I think he seems to be. And then he's not really a hero, but I think people like to paint him as such when they, like, think back and they're like, oh, poor Draco. Yeah. We should give him credit for all of the things that he did, like, for not being totally terrible in the end. And strengths that were listed were quick, imaginative, and strategic mind, high self-confidence, independent and decisive, hardworking and determined, open-minded, and jacks of all trades. Most of those I agree with, but open-minded, definitely not Draco. Like, he doesn't believe that a Muggle-born can do anything. But everything else I feel pretty in agreement with.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because a lot of those strengths, I think, are characteristics of Slytherin House. High self-confidence, hardworking, determined, quick, strategic mind. All of those are kind of traits that you can see associated with his house. So,
yeah, ambition and, like, believing that you can do whatever you set your mind to.
Yeah.
And then weaknesses, which I think end up being some weaknesses of Slytherin House, are arrogant, judgmental, overly analytical, loathe highly structured environments, and clueless in romance. So I think they're mostly accurate. Definitely arrogant, judgmental. I think it's interesting because Slytherins are often these things and often kind of have a disregard for the rules. The clueless in romance thing is just kind of funny. I don't know. Feels like a burn, but...
Yeah, well, I think that's interesting because in our sneak peek for our next episode, kind of a trait that can be associated to Slytherin House is having this, like, deep, dying love that's unrequited. So you can see how that kind of ties in there. It's very interesting.
Yeah. Draco's a pretty true Slytherin, I think.
Yeah.
And then finally, just a note on parenthood for INTJs, because we do get a glimpse at this with Cursed Child. It says, INTJ parents will likely never be able to deliver the sort of warmth and coddling that stereotypes say they should, and that they're not prone to overt displays of physical affection. So I think this definitely we see in Cursed Child. Scorpius, unfortunately, loses his mother young, and I think from that point on, he loses most of the warmth of his childhood. Draco doesn't know how to be a father because, I mean, we often talk about Harry not knowing how to be a father because he didn't have a father figure, and of course Draco has a father, he had a father figure, but not a good one. So I think Draco probably doesn't want to be like his dad, but he doesn't know how to be better, which I think segues right into your section here.
Yeah, because now I'm going to talk about Draco's childhood and kind of how he was raised and his parents. So I'm going to start off with a quote from J.K. herself. She writes, "I pity Draco, just as I feel sorry for Dudley. Being raised by either the Malfoys or the Dursleys would be a very damaging experience, and Draco undergoes dreadful trials as a direct result of his family's misguided principles. However, the Malfoys do have a saving grace. They love each other. Draco is motivated quite as much by fear of something happening to his parents as himself, while Narcissa risks everything when she lies to Voldemort at the end of Deathly Hallows and tells him that Harry is dead, merely so she can go get her son. So, I think it's very interesting that J.K. kind of understands, and maybe even did it on purpose, how Dudley and Draco, and I think that this can be extended to a lot of characters in the Harry Potter world, that you are a product of your environment, and how you were raised does play a hand in who you become. And I think that's a very common theme, kind of what you see with Draco, what we see with Dudley, what we see with Snape and his kind of tragic childhood backstory, and Harry himself. Harry comes out a little bit more positively, but we can still trace back to who he is based on his childhood and the things that happened to him then. So J.K.'s very aware of what she writes, and I think that's one of the things that makes her a great author. So I think we can all agree that Draco's childhood cannot have been a happy one. I don't think it was overly sad. Like, I don't think he had a bad childhood, really, but it definitely wasn't a warm, happy one. The house he grew up in was cold, and he had a cold father who, I think I would argue, didn't really love him that much. I think Lucius saw Draco as more of this kind of carrying on the bloodline, almost, just having a son, like, making his son into, like, himself, kind of thing, not so much, like, raising him to be a good person, a good citizen. Lucius was willing to give Draco up to Voldemort. He was willing to put his family in dangerous situations by letting Voldemort live in his house. And Voldemort effectively kind of kept the Malfoys hostage in their own house. And, I mean, Draco or Lucius didn't really have that much of a say in it to begin with because he's being punished. But he could have not been a Death Eater. Simple solution. So. And then I have a real issue with people defending Narcissa and kind of her becoming this martyr, almost being this hero. And I'm not saying that what she did to save Draco in the end when she lied about Harry being dead wasn't brave or wasn't out of a mother's love, and Harry was saved by a mother's love yet again, which is very poetic. But I think Narcissa gets this rap that is not deserved. People argue that she was a good mother who really loved and cared about Draco, and that when Draco grew up to be kind of a better man, a good man that we see in Cursed Child, people are like, oh, it was all down to Narcissa's love and her warmth and blah, 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 and her caring. And I think that that's not only doing Draco a disservice, because I think that he was kind of the person who pulled himself out of that himself, but it's also just, I don't think true. I don't think Narcissa is this, like, warm character that some people make her out to be. I don't disagree that she didn't love her son, but I think that if your redeeming quality is that you love your son, that's a pretty low bar to reach. If that's kind of the only positive thing we can get out of that, is that she loved her son and didn't want her son to die, like, good for you, Narcissa. Good for you.
Just that she put her son above Voldemort's cause doesn't mean it's a good, she's really that good of a mother.
Yeah, and like I said earlier, like, I understand that that was very brave and dangerous and for her to do, but, I mean, she does it for a very selfish reason. Like, she doesn't have this undercover, like, oh, I want Harry to survive and kill Voldemort. It's literally just so her son doesn't die, so she can go and see her son. And like I said, I don't think that really makes her that great of a person. I think that people can, bad people can love their children. I don't know. And I think one piece of evidence that's backing up my feelings on her is that it's mentioned that she disapproved of Astoria and the way that Draco and her were raising Scorpius. She still has this deep-seated prejudice against Muggleborns and Half-Blood. She still has this pure-blood is the best mentality. And she didn't really learn anything from the war. She was upset that Draco was raising Scorpius to be a loving, open-minded, like, man. And I think that's all the proof that I need to say that Narcissa didn't really change. She just loved Draco. That was her only redeeming quality. That's nothing more. Sorry. So going back to Draco's childhood, kind of away from my rant about Narcissa, people are a product of their environment, and Draco was raised from a young age to believe that he is better than most people and that he is somebody to be admired and envied. And so obviously that's going to affect how he sees himself. If you're raised being told you're the best and that you're better than people, you're going to start to believe that. So I think this is where a lot of his prejudice against blood traitors like the Weasleys and against muggle-borns like Hermione comes from, like his parents, obviously. And then he was also taught growing up that Voldemort was somebody to look up to, Voldemort was somebody to follow, Voldemort was somebody who was doing the right thing, doing the good thing, and doing good work, which
yikes,
we know is really not true. So, like I said, Draco is a product of his environment, and I think that you can kind of keep that in mind when you think about him, but I think that this whole cursed child version of Draco and feeling pity for how he's raised has kind of colored how people, his fans of Harry Potter, see him, and I think that they just need to go back and reread some of the books, because when you read some of the stuff that he does and some of the stuff that he says, it's really awful, and I don't think it's people forget that.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about some of that stuff.
Yes.
So, talking about Draco and Harry's relationship, first thing of note is that Draco's a Gemini, which is a sign that matches well with Harry's Leo sign. Shout out to the Dreary Shippers. But I think this is interesting. I assume that it's something that JK thought about just because she thinks about everything. But just kind of cool that she put that, I don't know, that's something of note in there. Yeah. And the other interesting thing about it is that Geminis aren't supposed to get along with Virgo or Pisces, which are Hermione and Ron's star signs. But I take issue with that, because I am a Gemini, and I think Hermione, Ron, and I would be friends, so a little offensive. So then, we're just gonna kind of go through Draco and Harry's relationship through the 7 books. Like Katie said, from the start, Harry has a bad impression of Draco. He is trash-talking Hagrid, he's trash-talking Muggleborns, but then, later on, Draco does extend his hand in friendship to Harry, and this probably has something to do with his childhood. A lot of Death Eaters after Voldemort, after Harry kind of killed Voldemort, they grew up thinking that Harry would be the next great dark wizard, because he defeated Voldemort. So Draco was probably raised thinking that. He probably heard the name Harry Potter, heard that he defeated this amazing dark wizard that his parents basically worshipped, and thought, oh, Harry's going to be the next dark wizard. Like, it's only right, passing on the torch. But Draco gets sorted into Slytherin, and Harry thinks even less of him. And Draco being sorted into Slytherin probably is why, one of the reasons why Harry is so against it, why he's chanting, not Slytherin, not Slytherin, not Slytherin, because he sees Draco get sorted, like, within a second, and then he knows that Draco is kind of a little rat, so why is he going to want to go into Slytherin?
Snake.
That's all he knows. Yeah, Draco's a snake. So then we can also trace some of their rivalry back to the first Quidditch lesson, where Malfoy taunts Neville and Harry stands up to him and beats him in flying. This is the first time Harry's ever been on a broom. And Draco, we would assume, has grown up playing Quidditch and stuff, and he grew up as a wizard. So McGonagall sees this, recommends Harry to be the new seeker, and Harry's like the youngest seeker in however long. And Draco immediately has been shown up. Like, he probably waltzed into Hogwarts thinking, oh, I'm going to be a big shot Quidditch player. Maybe not my first year, but definitely, like, along the line, I'm going to be a great seeker. I'm already a good flyer. And then Harry, who's never been on a broom before, gets on the Quidditch team and then excels. And Draco has to wait until the next year, which is when his father buys his way onto the Quidditch team with the Nimbus 2001s. So this is definitely just, like, it might seem like a little thing for Draco to be upset about, but, I mean, they're 11 years old. Of course he's going to be upset that Harry showed him up. So then, yeah, in Chamber of Secrets, Harry believes Draco is the heir of Slytherin and is the one going around petrifying students. So this is when him and Ron sneak into the common room, or go into the common room disguised as Crabbe and Goyle, and Draco says that he doesn't know who the heir of Slytherin is. But this is, like, one of the first instances where Harry is, like, certain that Draco is doing something bad. Like I said, Draco joins the Slytherin team, so that they now have this Quidditch rivalry cemented in their matches, and Draco also calls Hermione a mudblood in this book, which is pretty bad. In The Prisoner of Azkaban, Draco torments Harry all year because of how the Dementors affect Harry, and we know that JK used Dementors to talk kind of about depression in the real world as something that she had struggled with. And so basically, if you break this down, Draco is just bullying Harry for, like, what is being used as a metaphor for depression, which is terrible. Draco dresses up as a Dementor during the one of the Quidditch matches, one of Harry's matches, to throw Harry off his game and try and make him lose, which he isn't successful. I think he ends up getting detention with McGonagall because of that. And he's just a bully, like, straight up. That's terrible. He also gets his father to get Buckbeak on trial and sentenced to death because he gets a little scratch. And then in the Goblet of Fire, the bullying continues. Harry, of course, is in the Triwizard Tournament, and Draco does everything he can to get the entire school against him. He makes those pins, and he's all, like, touting about how much he supports Cedric, but really he's just bullying Harry.
Yeah, and I, shocker, I was just listening to Goblet of Fire not too long ago, and I think something that we forgot to put on this for Goblet of Fire is that Draco also spends that entire book trying to get Hagrid fired again, because he, like, sets Rita Skeeter up and, like, is feeding Rita Skeeter all those, like, really bad quotes about Hagrid and Harry and Hermione and just the whole thing with the Daily Prophet that year.
Yeah.
And especially working with Rita Skeeter is just, like, really awful. Some of the things that, like, they say about Hermione, like, there's the one where, like, they talk about Harry in the first article, and they're like, oh, Harry has had luck with girls around Hogwarts. Like, Hermione is reported to never leave his side, like a stunningly pretty muggle-born girl. And Pansy's like, stunningly pretty, you! Just, like, really rude. But moving on, in the Order of the Phoenix, Draco becomes a part of Umbridge's inquisitorial squad and pretty much works all year to expose Dumbledore's army and get Harry and Dumbledore out of Hogwarts for that, and with the inquisitorial squad, he's allowed to take away house points and give house points, so he pretty much just spends that whole year taking away house points from Gryffindors and Hufflepuffs and Ravenclaws. I think there was, one quote during this where they, like, look at the house hourglasses or whatever, and Slytherin is, like, almost overflowing and everybody else has, like, zero. So, yeah, that's a really effective way to give your students power, you know. So he spends the whole year just abusing his power that he gets. And then this is the year where he gets into the fight with the twins and Harry after the Quidditch match, and gets Harry and both of the twins banned from Quidditch, even though only one of the twins fights him and the other one's held back. But I'm just like, he would have fought if they weren't holding you back. And I think Draco says something very rude about Mrs. Weasley, and I think even Lily, and that's what incites the incident. And then after the Battle of the Ministry, at the end of this year, Lucius not only fails Voldemort by not getting the prophecy, but he's also captured and imprisoned in Azkaban. And so he's a big disgrace to Voldemort, and Voldemort decides to punish Lucius by giving Draco the impossible task of killing Dumbledore, or else he'll, like, kill Narcissa, basically, and getting Death Eaters into the castle. And so that leads us into Half-Blood Prince, where pretty much all Draco does all year is worry about accomplishing those two goals, and he is unsuccessful in killing Dumbledore, but he also uses some, like, really stupid ways to try and kill Dumbledore, like the cursed necklace and the poisoned mead. I guess those are pretty, like, non-violent, so he's not actually the one doing it, so maybe that's why he liked those. But he does succeed in getting Death Eaters into the castle, but this is very interesting because Harry becomes, like, completely obsessed with Draco this year. He follows him all the time around the castle. He'll, like, lay in bed at night watching Draco sleep on the Marauder's map, like, in the Slytherin common room, which is super creepy. Harry just, like, becomes really obsessed with him. And even Ron and Hermione are like, bro, calm down.
It's so creepy.
It's really creepy. And I think this is part one of the things that fuels the Drarry shippers, this book in particular. But, like I said, in the end, he doesn't actually succeed in killing Dumbledore, which I think is very important, because if Draco had succeeded, I don't think he would have been the same person that came out at the end of the war. When you, like, kill somebody, I think it changes some, like, it changes who you are and who and how you look at things. And it, like, I mean, that's part of the reason why you have to kill somebody to create a Horcrux. It literally destroys your soul.
Right.
It breaks a piece of your soul off. So I think it's very important that Draco wasn't actually the one who killed Dumbledore. And I don't think he would have, even if Dumbledore and Snape hadn't cooked up that plan. I forgot to mention, this is also the book where the Sectum Sempra incident occurs, where Harry, like, almost kills Draco, on accident, / kind of on purpose. Like, he cast the spell on purpose, but he didn't almost kill Draco, and I don't know, I think that's a very interesting part of their relationship, that particular incident, because Draco is so, like, I think you could say that he's probably depressed this whole year. Like, they talk about how he always looks sick, he's losing weight, he's paler than usual. I mean, he's going through some stuff of his own, and I mean, if I remember correctly, Harry's just kind of, like, he's crying. Like, Draco's crying in the bathroom, and Harry just walks in, and then they just start, like, dueling. Like, there's no really preamble to it. Just these two people, like, can't be in the same room together without exploding.
Emotions are running high.
Yes, for sure. And then, in Deathly Hallows, Draco spends most of the book at Hogwarts or hiding out at Malfoy Manor. So we do know that he went to Hogwarts for the seventh year, but we don't really know what he does during that year, how school is for him. I mean, we kind of see it from the Dumbledore's army perspective, when they talk about all the torturing and the detentions, but we don't ever see it from Malfoy, and I assume Crabbe and Goyle are back for their seventh year as well. So it'd kind of be interesting to learn what school was like for them and what they were up to. When Harry is captured and taken to Malfoy Manor, Draco is tasked with identifying Harry. And I think this is a chapter where a lot of people point to for Draco's redemption story, kind of, because he does not, in fact, identify Harry, even though we can say with some certainty that he knew that it was Harry. So the quote from that chapter is, "Harry saw Draco's face close up now, right beside his father's. They were extraordinarily alike, except that while his father looked beside himself with excitement, Draco's expression was full of reluctance, even fear. 'I don't know,' he said, and he walked away towards the fireplace where his mother stood watching." So, like I said, I think it's pretty, I think we can say, like I said, with some certainty that Draco does know that this person is Harry Potter, but refuses to identify him as Harry. I think that there are a couple different reasons for this. I don't think that any of them have to do with him wanting to save Harry's life. I think it could possibly have to do with him... This is going to sound, like, counterintuitive, but I don't think he wanted to save Harry's life, but I also don't think he wanted to be responsible for Harry's death, if that makes sense.
Mm.
I think it could have been he was afraid for Voldemort to come to the manor. I think that he had kind of lost faith in Voldemort and the Death Eater's cause. I don't think he really wanted to be a part of it anymore. So I think it could be any of those or any combination of those motivations.
I think the one that resonates most for me is probably fear. Because obviously he knows if they identify him as Harry, then Voldemort's going to show up. And I think he probably does all he can to avoid being in the same room as Voldemort, to avoid having all the Death Eaters gather. He probably just likes it when it's him and Mom and Dad and Auntie Bellatrix. Like, I think he was probably afraid of just Voldemort coming, didn't want it to happen, and then on top of that, if something were to go wrong and Harry were to escape again, which he does, he was probably afraid of Voldemort's anger. I mean, Voldemort already forced him to kill Dumbledore, or try to kill Dumbledore, because the Malfoys messed up. So imagine what's going to happen to the Malfoys if Voldemort knows that, that Harry was in Malfoy Manor and gets away.
Yeah, and I think also with that quote, it's very interesting to point out, kind of going back to his parents and how I was talking about them earlier, and the quote is very specific in saying that he leaves his father's side to go stand with his mother, so I think that also says a little bit about his relationship with his parents. And then later on, Draco, or Harry, steals his wand at this point at Malfoy Manor, which is obviously a big point in the whole plot line of the end of that book, and kind of, again, tracing the wand's allegiance, whether it's Draco's and the Elder Wands, how those kind of affect each other. And then, kind of going against what I said earlier about how he kind of had given up on the Death Eaters and Voldemort's cause, at the Battle of Hogwarts, Draco does not only fight on the side of the Death Eaters, but he actively, like, tries to catch Harry. He doesn't just stay on the other side, kind of complacent, not doing anything. He goes out and goes straight to find Harry at the Room of Requirement with Crabbe and Goyle, and he tries to capture him and bring him to Voldemort. So it's interesting seeing kind of that juxtaposition of he was so reluctant to do it probably, like, what, a week ago, less than a week ago at Malfoy Manor? Or, no, I guess because they go to Shell Cottage afterwards. So it was probably,
yeah,
like,
it's
weeks
like a
to a month. Yeah. In between, he was so reluctant to do it then, but now he's all like, I'm going to be the one to bring you to, like, Voldemort. It'll get my family glory again, and I don't know. So Draco, again, we kind of talked about how he's this, like, two-sided coin. Like, he's very gray. He's not black and white. He's very conflicted. He's a very conflicted character. We see that again here. And so this is when they go into the Room of Requirement, and obviously Crabbe casts the Fiend Fire, which is what kills him. And Harry saves Draco at this point, which, again, is a very interesting twist to their relationship.
Very.
Yeah, well, at the bare minimum, I feel like you can just say that Harry didn't want Draco to die as the basis of your ship. It's pretty...
Harry saves everyone, so...
Yeah. Harry's hero complex strikes again. And then, at the end of the Battle of Hogwarts, we see his family sitting in the Great Hall with everybody else, and nobody's paying any attention to them, and they're not paying attention to anybody, but they do look very out of place. But they're there, and nobody's making them leave. And that's kind of the end of Draco in this series. And at the end of this series, I think we can have hope that he would grow on to be a better person, and we do see that in Cursed Child. But speaking of Draco and Harry's relationship, their relationship is one that's very much built on jealousy. Draco is just straight up jealous of everything that Harry has and everything that he does. So Throughout the series, Draco spends all of his energy trying to discredit Harry and trying to prove to himself and others that he is better than Harry. And he never succeeds in this, and he knows that he never succeeds, and he's just always very jealous of Harry. He's jealous that Harry has friends that love and care about him and friends that he can rely on. He's jealous that Harry is the best seeker of the school when he thought Quidditch was going to kind of be his thing. I think he's jealous of Harry's popularity with students and teachers. I think Draco thought he was going to be the big man on campus, but it ends up being Harry. He's jealous that Harry has adults and parental figures that love him and care about him and are warm towards him. Like, he does have Narcissa, who I do think loves him, but I don't think Narcissa is very warm. Harry has the Weasleys, which is a better family structure than Draco has, even though Draco's real parents and Harry's parents are dead. And he's also very embarrassed whenever Harry upstages him. He's very embarrassed that Harry's the better seeker. He's embarrassed that Harry caused Lucius to fall out of favor with Voldemort not once but twice, when Harry destroyed the diary and when Lucius failed on getting the prophecy from Harry. The Sectum Semper incident, where Harry kind of got the best of him, I think he's embarrassed of that. And he just never succeeds in getting Harry punished. Whether it's with Dumbledore's army, whether it's with flying the Ford Angula, all he does is try to discredit Harry, and he never succeeds. And I think that's pretty much the short and long of their relationship.
So then moving on, it's kind of been a common theme in the fandom for girls to be, like, in love with Draco. And J.K. wrote a little bit about this. And I just want to read her quote. It's a little long, but I'll just read the whole thing because it's kind of funny. So she says, "For all this, Draco remains a person of dubious morality in the 7 published books, and I have often had cause to remark on how unnerved I have been by the number of girls who fell for this particular fictional character. Although I do not discount the appeal of Tom Felton, who plays Draco brilliantly in the films, and ironically is about the nicest person you could meet. Draco has all the dark glamour of the anti-hero. Girls are very apt to romanticize such people. All of this left me in the unenviable position of pouring cold common sense on ardent readers' daydreams, as I told them, rather severely, that Draco was not concealing a heart of gold under all that sneering and prejudice, and that, no, he and Harry were not destined to end up best friends." And I would just add, nor were they destined to end up as a couple.
Shut Drury down.
And then, just an example of this is someone tweeted Tom Felton a picture of a shirt that they bought. It says, "I bought this. What do you think about it?" And the shirt says, "Draco Malfoy is my boyfriend." It's just straight up very blunt. And Tom Felton says, "I'm not too sure Draco would be a good boyfriend. Ron, however," and then in parentheses, "at JK, I'm sorry, girls like Malfoy."
Tom.
Yeah, I never had those opinions, had those feelings for Draco, but it's common. And
we'll talk about it a little bit later, yeah, about my feelings about it. But yeah, I think that's hilarious that not only is it a thing, but both Tom Felton and JK have, like, acknowledged that it's a thing.
And it's not a good thing.
Yeah. Anyway, so we're going to talk about now Draco's Where Are They Now section. So a lot of this comes from Cursed Child, because we do see him be kind of a major character in that play. So, after the Battle of Hogwarts, Draco reconsiders his ideals and morals, and maybe even regrets his decision to join the Death Eaters, which, again, I think is true. I don't think this makes him, by any means, a good guy or a good character, but I think that he does kind of regret fighting on that side during the war. And he's able to carry on a cordial relationship with Harry, Ron, and Hermione, as seen in Cursed Child. And this is mainly due to the friendship between Scorpius and Albus. They're able to kind of be in the same room together and be kind to each other. Or maybe not kind, but
Not sectum semper each other.
Yeah, not sectum semper each other. Not attempted murder. And so he ends up marrying the little sister of a fellow Slytherin, Astoria Greengrass. So Daphne Greengrass was in Draco's year, and her little sister Astoria is the one that Draco marries. And I think she's 2 years younger than Draco. And so we don't actually know whether she's in Slytherin or not. We can kind of assume that she might be because her sister is, and then Scorpius ends up being in Slytherin. But yeah, and we don't know for sure. And then they have the son together, Scorpius. Fun fact, in Deathly Hallows Part 2, during the epilogue, the part of Astoria was actually played by Tom Felton's real-time life girlfriend at the time. I don't think they are together any longer. I could be wrong. I haven't checked in a while. But, fun fact. So, Astoria has a blood malediction, which is very interesting knowing what we know about from Crimes of Grindelwald now. Could she be a maledictus? Just like Nagini is? Could she... Anyways, could she turn into
related?
Is she related to Nagini? Nobody knows. We might find out later. But so this blood malediction causes her to kind of be weak and frail her whole life because she's ill with it. And then pregnancy makes her condition worse and basically causes her to go into hiding after the pregnancy and during the pregnancy. And this is when the rumors start to swirl around that Draco was unable to father a child, and so he and Astoria decided to go back in time and have a child with Voldemort. So that's kind of where the rumors that Voldemort is Scorpius' father start. And it's actually kind of heartbreaking because Astoria knew that becoming pregnant was probably going to be the end of her life, was probably going to kill her. But she wanted to have a child so that Draco wasn't alone after she died, which is just, really heartbreaking.
Yeah.
And then with Draco's job at the Ministry, it's never really said what exactly he does, but we do know that he worked for the Ministry of Magic. And then there's a quote from J.K. talking about Draco's post-Hogwarts life, so I'll just read it. I imagine that Draco grew up to lead a modified version of his father's existence. Independently wealthy, without any need to work, Draco inhabits Malfoy Manor with his son and wife. I see in his hobbies further confirmation of his dual nature. The collection of dark artifacts harks back to family history, even though he keeps them in glass cases and does not use them. However, his strange interest in alchemical manuscripts, from which he never attempts to make a philosopher's stone, hints at a wish for something other than wealth, perhaps even the wish to be a better man. I have high hopes that he will raise Scorpius to be a much kinder and more tolerant Malfoy than he was in his own youth. So I think that J.K. does a really good job kind of balancing this character of Draco, saying that he's not a saint, but he understands some of the stuff he did was wrong. He's trying to move on from that, and he's trying to raise Scorpius to be a better man than he is and was. So, I think it's interesting.
I think what's really cool about this is that J.K. straight up says that he is a dual nature, and as a Gemini, that's kind of one of the traits of Geminis, is it's like two-faced, two sides to them, like the twins. So Draco right there shows a little bit of his Gemini side.
Yeah. I just think that Draco is a very interesting character, and I think he's kind of similar to Snape in the fact that we can't make him a villain, but we can't make him a hero. I do think he's a little bit less redeeming than Snape. And I think people forget how kind of awful of a bully he was, but I think that there's a difference between him being a bully and him being a Death Eater, you know, and I think that's kind of where the line is drawn for Draco. He may no longer be a Death Eater, but that doesn't mean he's a nice, kind man, kind of thing. And I think that's important to balance those two sides of him, his dual nature. And then, so I have a restricted section for this episode, which is, again, kind of our unpopular opinions, maybe about the character or subject that we're talking about. So I am very ashamed of this, and I kind of hate myself for having this belief, but I am a little bit, just a little bit, of a Hermione shipper. And I know we just talked about how Draco is not meant to be, meant to have crushes on, or he's not going to be a good boyfriend when we were talking about how girls are in love with him, but I can't help it. I'm a sucker for a bad boy, and I think that Hermione, if anybody could change Draco and make him into a better man, I think it would be Hermione. And I understand that Draco is really, really awful to Hermione in school years, and I think that I'm kind of a hypocrite because that's why I think Snape really never loved Lily because of how he called her mudblood, and Draco does the same exact thing to Hermione. But I think a lot of this stems from Tom and Emma, who I ship in real life. So I think I could trace it back to that, but yeah, like I said, I think I kind of hate myself for this. They're definitely not my number one ship, but they're kind of the only one that I semi support that is not canon. So
okay.
Yeah, sorry.
I'm ashamed.
And then closing out our episode, speaking of love and crushes and schoolgirl crushes especially, our pop quiz question today is, which Harry Potter character do you have the biggest crush on?
Okay. So I was thinking about this, and I was thinking about it a lot in the context of the movies, because that's when we see them.
Yeah.
And definitely most attractive person, student at Hogwarts in the movies is Dean.
Yes.
I watched How to Get Away with Murder. I haven't watched this season, but yeah, definitely
so attractive.
Movies, Dean. But when I'm thinking books and how characters are portrayed in the book, Dean isn't that exciting. Maybe he's a nice guy.
Fan.
Yeah, I mean we could maybe make something work, but. I think I would have to go with Ginny because she's so, sassy and smart and cool, and I don't know. I mean, we get that perspective of her because, Harry's in love with her, so I also agree with Harry.
I knew you were going to say Ginny. So, I'm a sucker for a Quidditch player. I think I probably have two... equally big crushes, I think, probably with Cedric. Gotta represent the Hufflepuffs. I just think he's, such a kind, good-natured, well-rounded.
Also, Goblet of Fire.
Goblet of Fire, yes. I can only pick characters that appear in Goblet of Fire for anything. So, yeah, I think it'd probably be Cedric. Kind of unpopular opinion, though. I don't think Robert Pattinson is really that attractive. And I don't think he's really that attractive even in Goblet of Fire. I always thought Crumb was more attractive in that movie. I know. I don't think that Crumb is, really that attractive in that movie. But I think he's more attractive than Robert Pattinson. I did not have a thing for him. I did not think, even when the movie came out, I was just, not impressed. Mm. Anyways, I think Cedric... probably be tied for, if not a little bit above, either Fred or George. Probably George, because he's the one who lives, you know.
Spoiler alert.
Fred dies, yes. I always remember when I was, littler, which twin lived and which twin died, because Fred rhymes with dead.
Yeah.
And then, the twin who doesn't die is the one who loses an ear. George is the one who loses in here. But yeah, I think they're so fun, and I don't know. Like I said, I'm just a sucker for a Quidditch player.
I can see you also, if we got to know him more, I feel like Charlie.
Oh yeah.
Just big time your type.
Yeah, I'm just into a man's man kind of dude.
Okay.
Big sports fan.
Okay.
What can I say?
Let's wrap this up.
I need somebody to eat wings and drink beer with me.
You don't even drink beer.
I drink some beer. I mean, I would probably drink cider, but if we're getting a pitcher, I drink beer. And watch hockey games.
All right, so go subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, and you can download our episodes and listen to them. They're released every other Tuesday. The next one coming up is Slytherin House.
Ooh.
So carrying on this Draco Slytherin theme. And make sure to leave us a review if you like us.
Yes, please. Don't if you don't like us. And then you can find us on social media. You can like our page on Facebook, which is Wizard Studies Podcast, or you can follow us on Instagram, again, Wizard Studies Podcast. I just posted an Instagram story of us recording, so...
Yeah, but that will have been posted, like...
Yeah, you can, if you watch it, you can remember it, and then, when you listen to this, you'll be like, ah, yes, I watched that live Instagram. Anyways, and then if you have any suggestions for episodes or pop quiz questions, because we really struggle on coming up with pop quiz questions, so any help would be appreciated, you can email us at wizardstudiespodcast@gmail.com.
All right, as always, thank you so much for listening. And remember, just do your best, we'll do the rest.
And learn until our brains all rot.